This is Nightmares of the Americas, Indigenous Tales. The show will start in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome, everybody, to Nightmares of the Americas, Indigenous Tales. I'm Joseph.
And I'm Gabriel.
And we are trying to work through some technical difficulties, everybody. So hopefully this episode comes out pretty good.
Hopefully. Hopefully we're not all laggy McGee.
It's super laggy right now. I don't know. Maybe it's the government infiltrating our site. That's probably what it is.
Solar flares. I've heard.
No, more like solar FBI.
We have been talking about them lately, so maybe they're trying to shut us down.
Yeah, we're on their list. It's all right. Oh, I don't trust those assholes anyway.
That's fine. It's good to be on a list.
It's never good to be on a list. No,
in my book, right. It is.
Oh, goodness. Anyway, what you been up to, Gabe?
Being on the FBI's list.
Okay, well, I guess this is what we're doing now.
No, I've just been living life, waiting for a good fishing trip. That's what I'm waiting for.
Yeah, I can't wait. We got a month left.
Yep, can't wait to be in the open sea.
Yep, fishing season starts on the 1st of May. So
yeah,
cool. Well, that's awesome, man. Yeah, I've just been, you know, getting treated like a dirty diaper by the universe. So I'm kind of over that already. I'm just tired of it. So hopefully this goes pretty good this week. My week has been utter doo doo, but you know what? We're recording. We're here. It's supposed to be a beautiful day. We're gonna go see some family. I think it's gonna be awesome.
Yeah, definitely.
And I'm hyped up to talk about this episode because this is gonna get wild. So I'm really excited.
Oh yeah, me too.
Well, if you want to do us a favor and give us a 5-star rating or review, we'd really appreciate that. If you want to get something free for that little review or 5-star rating, all you have to do is screenshot that, send it to info@bhillnetwork.com with your mailing address and your alias, and you'll get some stickers. So I just put a new order in for stickers because we ran out. So maybe in a week or so, everyone else will be caught up, and I owe a few stickers to some people who keep just slipping through the cracks, but I already talked to her, and I sent her something as a sorry and all that other stuff. So
oh, cool.
It's going to be pretty cool. Yeah, for sure. So go ahead and do that. And if you want to get in on our giveaway, it will be the last day today to get in on the giveaway. So if you're listening to it, when this drops on Tuesday, when is this? April 30th, it'll be the last day to get in on the giveaway. And March 1st, there'll be a drawing, and 3 lucky winners will receive a free gift. So go ahead and go to Instagram or TikTok to check all that stuff out at Indigenous_Tales, where all the details are. Just make sure you follow the instructions, all that goodness, and then you could be a winner. So that's going to be pretty cool. And if you want to check out some of the merch that you could potentially win, go to indigenoustales.threadless.com and go ahead and search there. Search, you know, sign up for the mailing list. They'll give you a discount. So even if you don't win, you'll have like, you know, pretty cheap option to buy some stuff. So go ahead and check that out. All right, so now that that's all over, let's get into the episode. So we left you last week with a little history of Wounded Knee and why this place was so important. AIM was pretty fired up, having just protested the charges against Darold Schmitz in the murder of Wesley Badhart Bull. If you remember, the state attorney decided to charge Schmitz with manslaughter instead of murder in the case. Badhart Bull's mother was thrown in jail for inciting a riot. However, the charges against other AIM members were dropped, and later her as well. So that's kind of where we left off with. And so let's get into the rest of the story. I want to start off with a quote from a journalist named Kevin McInerney. He was a journalist with NPR, and he was actually at Wounded Knee.
Oh, wow.
Like he was during the occupation, he was there. He directed a documentary in 2019 of a film titled From Wounded Knee to Standing Rock. Now, I don't know why I can't figure out how to watch this movie. I want to watch this documentary and I can't figure it out. Everything I go to is like, oh, do you have a library card? And I'm like, I sure do. They're like, we don't like your library. We don't support it. And I'm like, well, then, okay, can I pay for it? No.
That's weird.
We don't like your money. I don't know what's going on. So if anybody has watched that film and would like to respond how to watch it, please let us know at info@beholenetwork.com because I would love to find that. I even tried to find DVDs and I couldn't find them. I don't know what to do, but I would love to watch that. But he has a quote. He says, "It has been waiting to happen for generations. If you look at it as a storm, the storm has been building through abuse, land theft, genocide, religious intoleration for generations and generations. The storm built up and built up and built up. The American Indian movement was simply the thunderbolt."
Wow.
I mean, it's a really good quote, right? Yeah. I mean, it explains a lot what's going on and what's happening in this time. So FBI marshals had been notified that there were some people that need to have an eye kept on them. And these people were the members of the American Indian movement, also known as Indian extremists. Can't have those extremists. This is the 70s, right? So the FBI is in full force and ready to go. Most of the information I got is from a book called Wounded Knee, Still Bleeding. And I also watched a few docs on YouTube, and they're like short, like 15-minute docs or 10-minute docs. They're not that, you know, just with a couple of interviews and stuff. I did watch a couple of congressional hearings with Russell Means. So that was pretty cool as well. I also got information from the U.S. Marshal website and the FBI website. But we'll talk about those. They're a little biased.
A little biased, yeah. I would like so, to think so.
A little biased. So an example of this surveillance comes from the FBI. Only 21 days after the protest against Schmitz, right? Two agents saw a number of cars leaving Calico on the Pine Ridge Reservation heading east. They started following them to see where they might go. Who knows what they're up to, but the G-men knew they were up to no good. The assumption was they were heading to the BIA headquarters on the reservation, but they just drove by the buildings, flipping off the U.S. Marshals that were guarding
them. Yeah.
Get it. The G-men radioed this information to the headquarters, as they were doing this, they noticed there were more cars coming up from the rear, and this had become a full-blown convoy that they seemed to be right in the middle of. So these guys are tailing a couple of vehicles, and then they're like, "All right, call it in, Rick." I don't know if his name was Rick. I'm just saying Rick. "Call it in to Hoover." He's like, "Well, Hoover died last year, but I'll call it in to headquarters, Johnny." I said, "Wait there. Well, wait, where do all these radical Indians come from?" They pulled away, but they knew the direction they were heading. They were heading towards Wounded Knee. So the FBI marshals and BIA police had been hovering around Wounded Knee for the past year or so because of everything that had been happening on the Pine Ridge Reservation. They sided with Wilson, and I don't know about you, but it feels like they were just wanting something like this to happen, right? You don't have a large police force or FBI presence, especially FBI and U.S. Marshals, unless you're thinking, oh, it's going to go down. And somebody has an itchy trigger finger, and now we have a full-blown conflict, right?
Yeah. Waiting for any excuse to make something happen.
Well, a year before Wounded Knee, there was a boy who was accused of theft at a local trading post, and he was beaten for it.
Jeez.
Just for theft. So a group of men showed up at the trading post. They smashed a few windows, threatened the owners, Jim and Clive, and also broke into the museum next door and stole a few artifacts. So this pissed off Wilson to no end, and he got his good old buddies to get involved. The aforementioned G-men and U.S. Marshals and BIA police officers, because they were all on his side, which this book that I read, they describe Wilson as a right-wing, hippie-hating, government-loving, anti-Indian.
That sounds about right.
So it made me laugh because nowadays it seems like, I don't know how much of a right wing he would be because he's government loving. Well, it seems like right now, for some reason, all the Democrats that used to be real Democrats, now they love the FBI. Don't know why.
Yeah, it's really weird.
They love government overreach and big government, which is really weird because remember, guys, this is the 70s. We hated all those people. And all of a sudden it's like, you know what? We love them. It just bothers me because it's like we said thousands of times, don't trust the government. If you have somebody that you know that really trusts the government and is just blindly trusting and loves them for all, you know, you should keep an eye out for those guys.
You should put them on a list.
Yeah.
Make your own list.
The government, the U.S. government is supposed to be ran by the people, and it's not. It's ran by bureaucrats and a bunch of lobbyists, and no one really gives a crap about you, the American citizen, if you are an American citizen. So this is where it's kind of interesting, because I'm like, okay, I get it. He hated hippies. That was the whole thing, right? Right wings. The Republicans were like, ah, damn hippies. Nixon was trying to shave everyone's heads. He wasn't, allegedly. But you know, it was just one of those things. You just didn't like that kind of movement. They're protesting the war. Well, but now you have all these people who are like, you know what? We should support wars. It's like, whoa, where did you come from? Because you were the same dude that was in the 70s smoking joints with everybody talking about let's all get along. And now all of a sudden it's, we should give them more bombs and we should watch more people die. It's like, I don't know. This is why I hate politicians and politics and people who have to side right or left, because it's all the government just playing tricks and games.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I digress. Means dispatched a group of armed men to secure Wounded Knee ahead of his arrival. However, when he reached the scene, he found the looting of the trade post and museum already in progress, right? So he was like, okay, this is what we're going to do. Oh, crap, they're ready to do this. So he was like, all right, well, let's not do this. And he was unable to halt the chaos before ascending to the highest point of the valley, where he took... Now, this is where I was... This is another thing. So I watched two documentaries and read the FBI documents, and they're both they're similar. But this book has conflicting information. So I'm going to give you two different parts of information. You guys take it for what it is. So this part says that they took Father Paul Manhart hostage. So they were taking hostages, and they were allegedly sympathizers of Wilson. BIA agents, BIA accountants, people who work for the BIA office, this priests, all these people. So in the documentary, it said that the FBI spread these rumors that they had hostages to make the media look poorly upon AIM. And AIM said they also didn't have hostages. However, in the book, it says they had like 5 or 6 hostages. You could take that for what it is. I'm going to read some of the stuff with hostages, but keep in mind the FBI said there wasn't hostages. They said they'd been lying. So I don't really know what to figure out or what to understand or how to describe this. But from the book, they had a number of hostages, right? They had Jim and Jan, who acquired the controlling stake in their trading post and assumed management responsibilities. They were taken that evening. A number of other people were taken. And one big thing that they were talking about was that this family, the Gildersleeves, they had been residents of Wounded Knee for nearly 4 decades. One of the person, Agnes, was a mixed blood Ojibwe from Minnesota and a distant relative of a few other people who were allegedly taken. Initially arrived at Pine Ridge, Agnes worked as a clerk for the BIA. Clive, on the other hand, was a second-generation white trader who inherited the family business from his father and had spent his entire life on the Pine Ridge Reservation. Agnes's brother held a position as a BIA accountant. So these people are people who own the trading post and also had ties to the BIA. The trading post catered to the needs of the small village that had developed around the site of the infamous massacre. Despite the tragic events in 1890, where around all these women and men were massacred, right? So they had a trading post right there, and then the town kind of built around it. So in the late 60s, this is where a lot of this kind of goes a little wacky. So in the late 60s, Clive and Jim and other partners envisioned a grand memorial on top of a hill where the massacre victims were laid to rest. Their plan aimed to erect a monument reminiscent of those found on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., seeking investors from Rapid City. They neglected to consult tribal elders, however, and even attempted to gain control of the burial site's land from the Holy Rosary Mission. Their ambitious vision included the development of hotels and tourist-related ventures akin to those near the Black Hills. However, the controversial project never came to fruition, and it kind of left a stain on the Gildersleeves family's reputation. And when AIM members came in, they accused them of exploiting the massacre for personal gain.
Yeah.
Which it kind of seems like that's what they were doing. Oh, all these people died here, and you know what I'm going to do? We're going to go ahead and build a whole theme park around this area. So, kind of horrible. Some local grumbles around the slightly higher prices at the Gildersleeves Trading Post. Unlike the larger grocery store in town, it couldn't compete in terms of volume. However, it offered more than just goods for sale. The Gildersleeves, they extended credit to those in need and occasionally traded beadwork and art for essential supplies. In time of crisis, they provided assistance, such as the use of their phone or a ride into town. Their customer base consisted mostly of lifelong acquaintances with whom they shared deep connections to. So they would at some point, you know, help out and try to get that reputation. You know, they're trying to get the reputation back. That's how I feel it. That's how I see it. 82-year-old Wilbur Riggett, Agnes's brother, curated a collection of art and artifacts displayed in a museum adjacent to the trading post. This is the museum that's right next to it that got broken into. Despite charging admission, he did not profit significantly from it. His fascination with Lakota culture stemmed from his encounter with Dr. George Eastman, a prominent figure from the 1890 massacre, during his early years on a reservation as a BIA accountant. This encounter profoundly influenced Riggert, who, despite not having Ojibwe heritage, developed a deep appreciation for Lakota culture and history. He authored and sold an illustrated book titled I Am a Sioux Indian to visitors.
Just
despite being confined to a wheelchair due to an old baseball injury, he spent his days at the museum passionately sharing his knowledge of Lakota culture and history with visitors. So what was that?
Was it just self-proclaimed?
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of that one guy, the one we talked about. What was that? It was the cave?
With the red-headed giants?
Yeah, it might have been that one. Where it was, there was a trading post, and there was another guy who was a self-proclaimed native. I don't remember what his name was.
I can't remember.
You know what I'm talking about, though, right?
Yeah.
Oh, I bet you someone's like, we've listened to your stuff a million times. I know exactly what it is. Well, anyway, it kind of reminds me of that.
Man, that makes me, what kind of baseball injury did he have? Well, old-timey baseball, they didn't care, so.
No, they just kick you, break your leg, and throw it over your shoulder, and then you gotta hop to the next base.
They're all, walk it off.
Agents were equipped with high-powered rifles and armored personnel carriers, tasked with manning checkpoints. Orders from Washington instructed them to shoot to wound rather than to kill a...
That's...
Washington's like, well, guess what, guys? Shoot them to wound them. Don't kill.
Set phasers to stun, guys. Come on.
Yeah. So this was a directive that it posed challenges for FBI agents who are trained as investigators, not marksmen or soldiers. Because if you guys remember in the FBI, when we were talking about the creation of the FBI, Hoover had a completely different view of what the FBI should be.
Yeah.
He wanted the FBI agents to be studious.
No guns, I don't think. You
know, clean cut, no guns. He didn't want guns. Mm-hmm. Well, eventually they did get guns, but they weren't trained to be marksmen like U.S. Marshals or Texas Rangers. So these guys, they were just loose cannons with guns. So they're like, how do I shoot? I'm just going to start shooting at him. If he dies, well, then he dies.
Yeah, because they could say, well, I was just shooting to wound. I wasn't trying to kill him, and they'd get away with it.
Yeah, they were complaining, saying, how could us as an agent, lacking training with these weapons, accurately fire from hundreds of yards away?
That's so insane.
And they're like, well, that's the directive. So Tribbock, he was like the main guy for the FBI for the agents. He felt responsible not only for containing the AIM protesters within Wounded Knee, but also for managing the media frenzy and negotiating with the hostages. So he was the guy like, okay, we want to keep the media out of this. We don't want anybody involved. Like, we want to make this as quiet as possible because it was such a big deal, right? So the FBI decided to have a perimeter around the valley, forming a defensive barrier. Behind the scenes, Army officers provided guidance to the FBI and marshals, maintained the vehicles, and arranged for Air Force surveillance aircraft to capture images of the Wounded Knee defenses. Lacking the understanding of Wounded Knee's historical significance, Tribbock couldn't comprehend why the Army hesitated to deploy its civil disturbance unit to forcibly remove the occupiers. Pentagon leaders and the Nixon administration shared similar reservations about the optics of the operation, which, so it's working. Remember, we said last week that Means and Elders decided to choose Wounded Knee because of the significance of the massacre at Wounded Knee, knowing that the U.S. government is not going to want to see all these people killed again on the same place where they killed men, women, and children. The person that was in charge, like, what's going on? Can't we just get, like, let's just get these guys out of here? Nixon's like, I don't want to. No, we don't want to do it. So AIM leaders such as Means, Banks, and Belcourt, along with the occupiers, many whom were women and children, found themselves surrounded by their adversaries as their names and faces dominated headlines worldwide. So now they're getting kind of like they're getting recognition. Now, other prominent figures in the protest included Vietnam War veterans Carter Camps and Stan Holder, who led security details, Leonard Crowdog, a respected medicine man from the nearby Rosebud Reservation, Pedro Bissonnet, the Oglala leader of the anti-Wilson Oglala Sioux Civil Rights Organization. In the early stages of the Wounded Knee occupation, the occupiers braced themselves for imminent federal intervention, anticipating that authorities would descend upon them any moment, because they knew the power of the U.S. government.
Oh, yeah.
At this critical juncture, two state Democrat senators, James Borks and George McGovern, stepped into the light. Borks' involvement began when a staff member alerted him to the situation that was happening in Wounded Knee. Uncertain of the appropriate course of action, he responded to flipping through a South Dakota phone book and just randomly dialed a number. Allegedly, this is what happened. This seems a little too much Hollywood for me. Because what happened next was it connected him to a house that was the makeshift headquarters established by Means and Banks in Wounded Knee. So it just so happened to be the house
out of the entire phone book.
Yeah, that's just, it seems too fantastic, right? Means was a longtime acquaintance of the senator. Well, he answered the call and outlined the occupiers' demands. They sought negotiations involving Henry Kissinger, the Secretary of State. We talked about him a little bit. Senators William Fulbright and Ted Kennedy, another Kennedy.
Oh, Ted Kennedy.
Well, his brother Bobby was like all about the civil rights movement, and he was, standing with Martin Luther King Jr. And so like they were doing some stuff. So Abortsk, he swiftly contacted the senators. They displayed little interest in participating, but agreed to send a single staffer each. When Means insisted on Nixon's counsel, John Eckerman's present instead of Kissinger, he said, no, we're not going to be able to do that. Eventually, Means relented, stating that the hostages would be released upon the arrival of the negotiators. So the two senators, they showed up. They headed over there to Pine Ridge, where they were met by the agent in charge, Trimbach, to inform Means on their arrival and ensure the release of the hostages as promised. After waiting 3 hours in Pine Ridge for updates from the occupiers' village, you know what? They just got the two senators, we're not going to do this. They decided to just drive into Pine Ridge. They're like, we're just going to go to Wounded Knee. So they got into a car and put a white cloth on it, slowly drove into the valley where they're confronted by armed men. And they said, well, we're here to talk to Means. So let them know we're here. So they had a little talk and they decided they were going to release the hostages as promised. The two men, they said, okay, and they left. And by the time they got to Washington, yeah, that was pretty much the end of it, because it persisted for another 69 days. So they let go of the hostages as promised, but now you have AIM members and sympathizers in Wounded Knee. And this was not going as well for the government as they wanted. So by the book, this is what it says, that book that I read, by March 8th, all the hostages were released. They said likely due to concerns among AIM members about the negative publicity, which makes sense. With the hostages free, the only barrier preventing the hundreds of FBI agents, marshals, and BIA police officers, and also including Wilson's goons from taking action, was the fear of a potential repeat of the government's violent intervention at Wounded Knee. So they were like, look, we know they're not going to attack now because they haven't yet, and it's mostly because of the optics. Carter Camp and Stan Holder, recognizing the confrontation was growing imminent, they rallied all occupiers with military experience and began fortifying the areas by constructing bunkers. Armed with hunting rifles, including some acquired from the trading post, and limited ammunition, they were prepared for the inevitable, but they had plans to smuggle in more supplies, and they did. The firefight was in full force. Federal forces encircled the bowl-shaped valley where the occupiers were entrenched. These ensuing firefights, which escalated later in March, witnessed intense battles as both sides exchanged hundreds of thousands of rounds targeting the Wounded Knee fortifications and buildings. In addition to seeking the removal of Wilson, the occupiers presented a series of demands, selected more for their publicity value than practicality. The AIM leaders met with the agent in charge, Trimbach, on the first day of the occupation to press the recognition of enforcement of the Treaty of 1868, which granted significant land to the Lakotas. They also demanded the return of the Black Hills to the Lakotas, called for a congressional hearing to assess the national compliance with all 371 treaties signed with Native American tribes, and advocated for the establishment of an independent Oglala Nation. However, those demands were never met.
Of course.
Yeah, we're not going to comply with the 371 treaties that we signed. We're not going to do that. They don't really serve us very well, so we're not going to do it. The Justice Department mediated numerous ceasefires between AIM leaders and federal authorities, but each truce was very short-lived, with both sides often blaming the other for initiating a new fire. In a particularly intense exchange on March 23rd, approximately 2,000 rounds were discharged without casualties. However, 3 days later, tragedy struck with Lloyd Grimm, a marshal from Pine Ridge, who had ventured to the occupied village for the first time. He was struck in the chest by a bullet fired from an AIM-occupied bunker. He survived. However, the bullet severed his spine and it confined him to a wheelchair. So now a marshal was hit. And that's not good.
No, definitely not.
That's just one of those things. Like, now it's more fuel to the fire, right? We know we're shooting at each other, but if I get shot, I'm not going to like it. It's like that Louis C.K. joke. I mean, it's terrible. Like, war's bad. But maybe if you get shot in war, that kind of makes sense because you were shooting at someone else. Like, he goes, I know it's horrible to say, but it kind of reminds me of that. Like, I butchered the whole bit, but it's something like that. Life in the village became increasingly challenging for the occupiers with shortage of food, clothing, and medicine. Despite these hardships, some found solace in the communal experiences. They started to embrace traditional Lakota ceremonies led by Crow Dog, and finding a sense of liberation despite the ever-present threat from government forces. So in response to AIM's call for support, because Russell Means had a phone, like there was a phone there, and he was calling and doing interviews the whole time with reporters and media. Left-wing organizations provided aid in the form of food, ammunition, and supplies, which were smuggled past federal blockades and stockpiled in nearby safe havens. Celebrity and activists, including civil rights leader Ralph Abernathy and tribal member Anne May Pictou and her Ojibwe husband, rallied to the cause. Even as new sympathizers arrived, they strained the already limited resources of the occupiers, leading AIM leaders to vet at all times and sometimes turn away people who are deemed untrustworthy. So now you had all these people coming in, limited supply, which you want to help. But there's incidences where you don't know who to trust now.
Yeah.
Are they FBI agents acting? Are they, you know, are they some bad actors? Are they people who are spies? Because, again, the 70s, they love all that stuff. Man, this was they do. So even though the federal authorities tried to restrict access to the village, an influx of outsiders attracted attention from the media. Means, Banks, and Belcourt seized the opportunity to convey their message of indigenous rights and resistance, captivating audiences with their fiery rhetoric and charismatic presence. Russell Means emerged as a prominent spokesman, leveraging his telegenic appeal and media savvy to garner widespread attention and sympathy for the protesters' cause. As the occupation unfolded, AIM's narrative of indigenous empowerment and resistance overshadowed federal attempts to discredit them, presenting the occupiers as freedom fighters against historical injustices inflicted upon Native Americans. Despite the government's effort to portray them as criminals, AIM's message resonated with a global audience, amplifying calls for justice and recognition of indigenous rights. This is exactly what they wanted to happen. So this is something that Wilson should not have really been involved in, but because he's this guy and he's the government's guy, they kind of let him get away with a few too many things. Wilson, he positioned his goon squad outside the federal perimeter, mandating that even federal officials seek right to passage.
That's pretty bold.
That's extremely bold. And they let him do it. That's what's insane. That's how you could see, like, this was their guy. they wanted him in office because they like he was like, oh, we're even going to vet the FBI agents. If you usually the FBI will just slap you around, just go right through that. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, when the media saw what was going on, the FBI thought, you know what? Optics don't look good. And then they made Wilson's group disband.
Are you making us look bad over here?
Yeah. Well, because even the media sees it and they're like, hold on. Why are there like who are these guys? They're not officials. They're just the goons of the man in charge, and he's not allowing FBI to go through. He's like not allowing the press to get through, and then you still have to go through the blockade of the FBI. So this, it didn't look good for him. The widespread publicity had elevated the site and its actions as an inspiration to Native Americans across the nation. Around this time, the leaders proclaimed the territory of Wounded Knee as the independent Oglala Nation and called for negotiations with the U.S. Secretary of State, because this is what they wanted to do, be separate, a separate nation. The nation extended citizenship as well to those who desired it. Now, here's the thing, even including non-Indigenous individuals. So allies that were willing to go with them, they were saying, hey, this is an independent nation. You're allowed to be citizens of this independent nation, regardless of your heritage. A small delegation led by Grandfather Chief Frank Fulcrow, the senior elder, along with his interpreter, traveled to New York in an effort to address and gain recognition from the United Nations. Despite receiving international news coverage, they were not acknowledged as a sovereign nation by the United Nations. According to John Sayer, a chronicler of the event at Wounded Knee, the military equipment utilized during the siege included 15 armored personnel carriers, clothing rifles, grenade launchers, flares, and over 133,000 rounds of ammunition.
Wow.
With a total cost exceeding $500,000. Including the expenses of maintenance personnel from the National Guard of five states, pilots, planes for aerial photography, the finding by historians record, and this journalist. Well, they were like, oh, maybe it was like BS, right? So they went and looked back through the records and they were like, no, that makes sense. Yeah, they had automatic weapons, snipers, helicopters, airplanes, 50 caliber machine guns, and over 130,000 rounds of ammunition. So this guy got the scoop, this chronicle, like spot on. This guy got the, he was like, no, I know exactly what they have. And he leaked it.
God. Grenade launchers.
Grenade launchers. Jesus. 50 cal machine guns and automatic weapons. I mean, they were ready to just decimate them. So I could see why the U.S. government's like, oh, shit. Oh, man. We can't do this again. Like, it's not going to look good if we just mow all these guys down on the same place where our government did it before. The accounts of the U.S. government force at Wounded Knee vary, like I said, but all sources agree it constituted a significant military presence comprising of federal marshals, FBI agents, and armored vehicles. One eyewitness and journalist described the scene, including sniper fire from federal helicopters, bullets hitting the ground, and the pervasive sound of gunfire throughout the town day and night. So he saw like them shooting like sniper rifles from the helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
So man, this is a full-on assault.
That's terrifying.
Russell Means, there's a video of him where he says, we're not going to disarm like they did the first time at Wounded Knee. Because if you remember, they agreed to disarm and their Wounded Knee massacre. And when they did disarm, when firefighting started happening, a lot of them were left disarmed because they took their weapons away and now they weren't able to protect themselves. So because of this, Russell Means like, no. History repeats itself and it's doing the same thing and we're not going to disarm. So on March 13th, Harrington Wood Jr., the Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Division of the U.S. DOJ, became the first federal government official to enter Wounded Knee without a military escort. He was determined to resolve the standoff peacefully. He engaged in days of negotiation with AIM leaders, although exhaustion prevented him from conducting the talks even further. Some credited him as the icebreaker between the government and AIM. After 30 days, the government approached Tuffend with the appointment of Kent Frizzle from the DOJ to oversee the response. Frizzle implemented harsh measurements such as, well, this is what we're going to do, cut off their electricity and water and food supply.
There you go.
Yeah. U.S. government attempted to starve out the occupants. Well, AIM activists, well, they had their own underground tunnel, and they were getting support. So they were smuggling food, medical supplies. Mm-hmm. I was listening to an interview from another reporter that was there, and they smuggled him onto the reservation into Wounded Knee. And he recounts everything. And he's like, the federal government was saying, if we go in there and we get shot, like, that's our fault. So at the time, the government was still trying to play their games. They were like, oh, they're the bad guys. They're the hostiles.
Yeah.
And they were wanting the media to portray them as such. But at this time, you know, I guess the media decided they were going to be non-biased, which today they're completely biased because they're bought and sold by the lobbyists, which I'm not going to go into. But back then, you actually had true journalism. And they were like, no, we're going to go in and see what's going on. We're going to tell the truth. And they did.
Yeah.
So also during this time, Dick Russell, his goon squad, they were telling the FBI that they were going to get to the bottom of this smuggling operation. So Kiefer, the U.S. deputy marshal at the scene, he said, there were no individuals between federal agents and the town. So you're not a part of this, guys. Like, you go ahead and settle down. We're not going to have the goon squad out there trying to do all this extra stuff. The Marshal Service opted to wait out the AIM followers to minimize casualties on both sides. Throughout the siege, the FBI, well, they decided to do something that the FBI really loves. Misinformation.
Famous for it.
So they were like, yeah, we're just going to spread misinformation. Nowadays, I mean, there's a lot of younger people who don't remember the time before 9/11. I do remember that time. But before 9/11, it was a lot smoother than it is now. Now they just go, you're wrong, misinformation, disinformation, not information. We control the information. We're the information holders. Everything else is not right. No, we're not going to do this. Back then, it wasn't like that. So this was kind of like a hush-hush. No, they were like, oh, we're going to spread this misinformation to undermine AIM's unity and public support. Initially, the federal government falsely claimed, now see, this is where I got it from, that AIM held hostages at Wounded Knee. But then the FBI also said, like, that was just misinformation. So when I read that book, I was like, wait, wait, wait. One, the FBI said it was misinformation. Maybe it's disinformation. I don't know. So maybe there were hostages. Maybe there weren't. I can't really find, there's conflicting information on both ends. I don't want to really trust the FBI. So I'm kind of leading towards maybe there was
fake news.
Oh, gosh, here we go. Now Trump's in the mix. Everything's fake news. On April 1st, the FBI hinted at divisions within AIM leadership and other occupiers, a claim that was refuted by Dennis Banks and Russell Means the following day. Both AIM and federal government documents indicated that the two sides exchanged fire for much of the 3 months. Among the indigenous supporters who joined the protest were Frank Clearwater and his pregnant wife, Cherokee people from North Carolina. So on April 17th, Frank Clearwater was fatally shot in the head within 24 hours of his arrival while seeking refuge in an occupied church during what both sides describes as a fierce firefight with federal forces. AIM supporters evacuated Frank Clearwater from the village, but he succumbed to his injuries in the hospital on April 25th. However, when Lawrence Buddy Lamont, a local Oglala Lakota, fell to a government sniper bullet on April 28th. He was laid to rest on a site in a Sioux cemetery. Following his passing, tribal elders, they were done with it, and they urged an end to the occupation. So this came directly from the tribal elders. It didn't come from from AIM. So knowing Buddy and his mother were from the Pine Ridge Reservation, many Oglala people were deeply saddened by his death. And both sides agreed to disarm on May 5th. So this wasn't a you and me, like we're going to disarm and then you guys are going to, no, this was like, everybody's just going to stop. So I think they had a little more faith in the government because the media was around and this was kind of a nationally televised event that was going on. So everybody put down weapons. So it seems like AIM felt comfortable disarming that way. The terms of the agreement mandated a meeting on Chief Fool's Crow's land in Kyle to discuss reinstating the 1868 treaty. Following the decision, numerous Oglala Lakota people began departing Wounded Knee undercover at night. walking through the federal lines. 3 days later, the siege concluded and the town was evacuated after 71 days of occupation, with the government assuming control while leaving corrupt Dickie Wilson still in office.
Yeah.
Now, here's something that I was reading. So this man named Ray Robinson, he's a black civil rights activist. He traveled to South Dakota to join the Wounded Knee occupation, and he was observed there by both a journalist and a white activist. So he disappeared during the siege, and his body was never recovered.
Whoa, that's kind of spooky.
Carter Camp, an AIM leader, asserted years later that Robinson had left on his own accord, seeking assistance for a wounded leg. Others allege that Dick Wilson and his goons were responsible for Robinson's disappearance, as well as for various injustices attributed to AIM and many of other families during the siege. Ray's widow, Cheryl Robinson, believes he was murdered during this incident. So Ray was a pacifist boxer, which is what I was, there's a whole bunch of information about this man. And he was a, him and his wife, when they got married, they had a farm and they would grow fruits and vegetables for the Black Panther organization. And he was really big into civil rights. And some say this is more the misinformation, because Wilson would also throw in some of this misinformation. They said that, oh, well, Ray, he got in an argument with AIM because of the fighting, because of the firefights. And Ray Robinson wasn't that type of guy. But then when you look at it, you would say, well, he knew they were shooting at each other and he decided he was going to show up.
Yeah.
So that doesn't seem to be the case. It seems like somebody killed him. And a lot of people think it is Dick Wilson, because we'll get into some of his stuff in a few minutes. So following the occupation, public opinion polls revealed widespread sympathy for Indigenous Americans at Wounded Knee. They garnered support from the Congressional Black Caucus, as well as various actors, activists, and prominent public figures, including Marlon Brando, Johnny Cash, Angela Davis, Jane Fonda, and Tom Wicker. When the Department of Justice prohibited media access to the site, attention waned. However, actor Marlon Brando, an AIM supporter, enlisted Sachin Littlefeather, an Apache actress, to speak at the 45th Academy Awards on his behalf, as he was nominated for his performance in The Godfather.
Hmm.
Littlefeather appeared at the ceremony adorned in traditional Apache attire. When Brando was announced the winner, she delivered a improvised speech on his behalf, stating his refusal of the award due to the poor treatment of Native American in the film industry. She was informed that she could not deliver Brando's original speech and was warned of potential arrest if she exceeded her allotted time on stage.
Wow, they're going to arrest her just for being on stage?
So they escorted her off the stage.
That's insane. We don't like what you're doing, so we're going to arrest you.
Later, she privately conveyed his original words about Wounded Knee to numerous press members backstage, reigniting the interest of millions in the United States and worldwide media, despite federal forces turning away Angela Davis as an undesirable person when she sought to enter the Wounded Knee in March 1973. AIM participants believe that the attention drawn by such public figures deterred U.S. military intervention. Residents reported experiencing physical attacks and intimidation from President Dickie Wilson and his supporters and his goons. The murder rate between March 1st, 1973 and March 1st, 1976 averaged 56.7 per 100,000 annually. In comparison, Detroit had a rate of 20.2 per 1,000 in 1974 and was considered the murder capital of the U.S. So Detroit's the murder capital of the U.S. at 20.2 per 1,000 per 100,000. But on Pine Ridge, it was 56.7 per 100,000. So that was more than double.
Yeah.
While the national average stood at 9.7 per 100,000. So that shows you, like, the national average, 9.7. Detroit, 20.2. And Detroit's the murder capital of the U.S., which tells me that they didn't consider reservations part of the U.S.
No, they definitely did not.
Over this period, more than 60 opponents of the tribal government died violently, including Pedro Bissonnette, the executive director of OSCRO, which is the one, the elder who wanted to start the entire thing against Dickie Wilson, start the impeachment. Well, he found himself dead. They don't know why. AIM representatives asserted that many of these deaths were unsolved murders, although FBI says that in 2002, the FBI issued a report disputing this claim. Despite the FBI's assertions, there were numerous suspicious circumstances surrounding the murders of AIM activists and the subsequent investigation, or lack thereof. Anne May Aquash, an activist who participated in the events of Wounded Knee, was later suspected of being a government informant.
Whoa.
However, it was later revealed that much of the effort to discredit her stemmed from Douglas Durham, an FBI informant, which is more the misinformation, right? So these are the tactics that they would use. Well, Anne May Aquash was discovered deceased near Highway 73 on February 24th, 1976. Her cause of death was attributed to, guess?
Hypothermia.
Exposure.
Yeah, natural causes.
Yep, natural. Yeah, she just went out there and laid down.
She fell asleep, and then just Mother Nature took its course.
Well, no, she fell asleep because she was drunk, because suggestions of alcohol involvement, despite there was none detected in her bloodstream, you know. So they said she was a drunk Indian, fell down in the winter of 76, and died of exposure, right? Well, the OSCRO, they were dissatisfied with this determination, and they requested an exhumation, which revealed she had been shot in the back of her head at close range.
How do you... These
open
people...
Open and shut Kate Shelton.
Yeah, these people.
Guys, this is what we're talking about when we say the government, don't trust them. We're saying this over and over. It's like if you follow all these political things, like just... I care enough because it's so blatant in your face. But you'll see things like, oh, this guy's going to go to trial against this big senator. Or this, you know, organization. And then all of a sudden they're found dead. And it's like, oh yeah, suicide. How do you do it?
Two gunshot wounds to the head, but it's suicide.
To the back of the head. Suicide. It's like, wait, what? Like, how is it? It doesn't make sense.
Or there'll be like a gunshot to the head, but then they hang the body. So like, oh, he hung himself, but... shot himself before he did it, so makes sense.
There was the guy who they said it was an accidental death, and he was bench pressing, and it was the bar on his chest that crushed it, and then they had him dragged down by the river, and then he had a gunshot wound to him. They said, oh yeah, he killed himself, or it was accidental death or something. It's like, wait, what?
It's so insane.
So this is a tale as old as time, right? Here's something that I want to talk about as well. So Frank Clearwater, right? We talked about him. He was the Cherokee with his wife that came from North Carolina. So after everything was said and done, Wilson presented an FBI document identifying the deceased man as Frank Clear, a Virginia native who had been dishonorably discharged from the Army during World War II for desertion during the Italian campaign. According to the reports, Clear was found sleeping in one of the occupied homes hours after his arrival when a stray bullet penetrated the wall, fatally striking him in the head. Despite efforts of asserting his identity and the reasons for his presence at Wounded Knee, the circumstances surrounding his death still remained uncertain. So this Frank Clear guy, some say he was native, some say he was like a legit guy that was there. But Dick Wilson said, no, I have the FBI documents. He was an informant. He was on our side.
And like he was fabricated.
Right. So that's what I said. There's a lot of like shadow information or hidden, like stuff we're not going to know. In 1974, Russell Means contested the Pine Ridge election against Dick Wilson. Fraudulent practices, including voter fraud, inadequate poll monitoring, and lack of oversight. Despite losing to Russell in the primary, Wilson still, however, became victorious in the election. So that kind of shows the voter fraud, right?
Yeah, and the good thing, like, nothing happened. He didn't get to Russell like he got his other opponents. I'd be scared.
I mean, Russell Means didn't seem like he was afraid of anything. He kind of just kicked everything.
No,
he was like, no, I'm going to spit in the face of injustice. At the urging of AIM, the U.S. Commission of Civil Rights investigated the election and determined it to be permeated with fraud. However, no formal action was taken to address these issues, and Wilson retained his position. because he is the government guy, and that's who they wanted in office. Following an 8.5-month trial presided over by Judge Fred, Joel Nickel in the U.S. Court, U.S. District Court of South Dakota, charges of conspiracy and assault against Dennis Banks and Russell Means were dismissed. The jury had unanimously voted to acquit both defendants of the conspiracy charge, but deliberations were interrupted when one of the jurors suffered a stroke before the second vote could take place. The government, they refused to accept the verdict of 11 jurors, and they said, nope, it's a mistrial. Because they wanted him to go to, they wanted them to go to jail, right? So
yeah, that's so one more is going to make a difference.
The defense team, they filed a motion for judgment of acquittal. The judge granted the dismissal, citing prosecutorial misconduct and stating, it is my belief, however, that the misconduct by the government in this case is so aggravated that a dismissal must be entered in the interest of justice. So this judge was like, you guys have done so much crazy stuff to these people. No, they're good. No. In 1975, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals determined that the government's appeal was barred by the Double Jeopardy Clause and dismissed it completely. Despite the government's attempt that jurisdiction should be assumed due to the public interest in the fair trials resulting in just judgments. The legacy of the Siege of Wounded Knee is marked by continuous debates stemming from the controversial tactics employed by both AIM and the FBI. The FBI has been criticized for potentially employing underhanded methods to undermine AIM, including tactics such as releasing false information and deploying undercover operatives to sow discord within AIM and Wounded Knee. Additionally, it has been suggested that the FBI, along with Nixon and the federal government in general, were too preoccupied with the Watergate scandal at the time to adequately address the situation at Wounded Knee. The federal government believes that had they prioritized the events at Wounded Knee more effectively, the siege wouldn't have happened. They would have been able to stop it.
Of course.
They said, hey, we were too busy about Watergate, but you know what? If we were there.
If we had our undivided attention.
Then we would have got it. So journalist Kevin McKiernan, he was the NPR journalist with that documentary that I can't watch because they won't let me. He covered the occupation as a rookie reporter for NPR. He says the image most people have of the occupation is one of violence and guns, of which there were plenty, with the government later admitting to firing some 500,000 rounds into the area. But he doesn't think that's the whole story. The real story in my mind were the religious ceremonies that took place inside Wounded Knee. This became kind of a laboratory for the hundreds who came there and getting their religion back, learning some of their language, which led to a revival. And these are two components of what I would look at as a core identity, language, and religion. So I wanted to end on that.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of crazy stuff that happened at Wounded Knee. I can't believe these guys, like the FBI, just with their misinformation. They handled it just like you would think they would handle it.
Yeah, it's just the whole wanting to be in control of the narrative, too, like trying to get the media to share what their view on what was going on is and not let anyone else really know what's going on. It's like it still happens today.
Oh, except today the media is implicit.
Oh, yeah. They're 100% in on it.
There is no more freedom of the press because they're bought and sold by lobbyists who are owned by companies, the special interest groups. And there's no good journalism anymore.
Yeah. Like when there's compilation videos of certain stories that happen, like groundbreaking news where everyone's talking about it, and they'll put all the clips side by side and they all say the exact same thing word for word. It's insane.
Yeah, I watched that video. It's nuts. It's nuts. And people get upset about these journalists that are outside of the mainstream. They're like, oh, well, this person, they're spreading misinformation. You know what? Let them say what they're saying. The truth always rises to the top.
Yeah.
So let them say what they're going to say and let someone debunk them. Like, I don't understand. If someone has a dumb ass opinion or like a dumb way of thinking, like, you know, this is the truth. And then you listen to them and you find other people are okay. Well, this is why it's wrong. And they dispute them. Well, now you have the information. Regardless if they're saying the truth or not, you could follow the whole thread of everybody talking. Mm-hmm. You could do your own research. You could find out what actually happened and what the truth is.
Yeah, a lot of the truth is out there. It just gets overshadowed by just what you said, or just people not wanting to really look into it for themselves, too.
That's how it goes. Mm-hmm. And I just don't get it. That was the Occupation of Wounded Knee. Like I said, there's some documentaries, there's some books. Go ahead and buy all those things and check them out, or rent them. Or if you can figure out how to watch that doc, send it to me mm-hmm. so I can watch it, because I really want to watch it. The good thing that happened was it brought a lot of people together. And this was before you were able to practice your religion, practice your ceremonies, practice your rituals. And they were doing that. They were out there at Wounded Knee, and people were reconnecting with their indigeneity. They were learning their language, and it really meant a lot to these people. I mean, it means a lot. And because of them, we're here today. I mean, those are the OGs, right? Those are the guys who fought and did all this stuff. So we can have a platform, so we can speak our voices and our minds and opinions and stuff, and still talk about the injustices that happen.
Yeah.
When you think about it, I mean, that wasn't very long ago that you weren't able to go to a powwow. You weren't able to go to a ceremony. You weren't able to dance. And these are the guys who paved the way and brought the rights for our people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So very important stuff. So we hope you guys enjoyed that episode. And then we'll start getting into some, I don't know, maybe we're going to start getting into like a listener tale or something, like some kind of show, like some kind of.
Yeah, we haven't had one of those in a while.
Yeah. Maybe we can tell some stories.
Bigfoot,
or some,
part seven.
Oh, gosh. And he's like, so there I was. There are body parts everywhere.
Oh, no.
There are fish body parts. So it's fine.
Oh, good. Bigfoot in space.
Yeah. Bigfoot in space, 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 space. He's all, what am I doing here? Why do I still have a cigarette, man? That's kind of weird. So do all the stuff on top of the show. Hopefully you get in on the giveaway, and we hope you enjoyed our series on AIM. So until next time, I'm Joseph.
And I'm Gabriel.
You'll be remembered by the tracks you leave.
And remain close to the Great Spirit.
And don't trust the damn government, I'm telling you. Don't
misinformation.
They're all liars. Misinformation, disinformation. They always try to do bad stuff to you. The political system is a failure. Bye.
If you're not spiritually connected to the earth and understand the spiritual reality of how to live on earth,